The topic is design. If you want to prove God, there's a multiple different ways you can do that. But I think one of the best ways is to show that the universe has been designed. Simply because, as we said last week, you never have design without a designer. Design has never happened by chance, never will happen by chance. There has never been an exception to that, and there never will be an exception to that. So if you could show design of the cosmos, you show a designer. Yes?
Ron, do you have a working definition of design?
Yes, I was going to get to it. Thank you. Design, as we covered last week, is a combination of basically two important data points. One, you have complex patterns. Two, that those patterns indicate information or contain information, or they have a common purpose. For example, you have a machine. Let's say it has a couple of hundred parts in a machine. And each of those parts are finely machined, precisely machined, and put together to accomplish a given purpose, whatever that machine's purpose is for. Nobody would ever think that those parts happen by random chance or could happen by random chance because it's impossible. You have design, you have a designer. And so we look at the universe as sort of a giant machine. Look at all the various hundreds and hundreds, now over 1,000 aspects or parts, if you will, of the cosmological machine that are all finely tuned to for at least one purpose, and that's to get an Earth-like planet in the cosmos. So when you look at all the parts and you see that they're finely tuned to accomplish at least one purpose that we know of, to get an Earth-like planet in the cosmos, that is design. Yes?
John, you mentioned purpose a couple times. And so you've mentioned complex pattern, information, and purpose. And I think purpose is a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't there maybe three criteria?
No, you might say, information / purpose, yes. For example, the side of a mountain, it has complex patterns to it, right? But there's no purpose or information conveyed. You look at Mount Rushmore, the side of that mountain, and you'd say, ah, that's design, obviously. You know, with the four faces of the presidents chiseled into the side of the mountain. You have complex patterns and they convey information, i.e., the four past presidents of the United States. So you have information. You see, I love you written in the sand, that's a complex pattern that conveys information and undoubtedly purpose as well.
Yeah.
And nobody in a right state of mind would think that that happened by chance, would you? Yes?
What if the I love you were written in a script form with someone's signature characteristics to that script?
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd have a whole lot more information, wouldn't you?
Yes. If you say I love you, like Gloria, my wife's name, it would, you know, you start getting, what are the odds of that happening by chance? Nobody in their right mind would ever think that that happened by random chance. And so last week we covered about the universe and the Big Bang. We didn't spend much time on that because we've been over that a lot in this class. And we saw that the Bible and the Big Bang perfectly agree with one another on the basics of the Big Bang or the basics of biblical cosmology. They're all the same. That everything had a beginning, matter, energy, space, and time. Therefore, you have to have a pre-existing agent that preceded the universe to bring it into being. We know that pre-existing agent as Jesus Christ, the God of Scripture. Also, we saw that by the fine-tuning of the universe, we started that, and we're going to complete that today, where fine-tuning of the various aspects of the universe indicates design. And we covered some initial factors, and this is where I basically left off last week. Initial factors right after the Big Bang. I mean right after the Big Bang. some of them within milliseconds of the Big Bang. Various things had to be so finely tuned. If they weren't, you would have no Earth happen at any time in the cosmos. And we talked about dark energy is finely tuned to 1 out of 10 to the 120th. We talked about the expansion rate of the universe at that point was so finely tuned, if you budged it 1 out of 10 to the 57th, you'd get no life or no Earth-like planet ever. And I illustrated like 10 to the 57th, what is that like? Well, that's pretty close to saying if you filled all of the 200 billion galaxies in the universe, fill them all with dimes, remove one dime, no Earth, anytime, anywhere. That's how finely tuned that number is. And so when you add those, and also the ratio of gravity to the electromagnetic force is 10 to the 40th. So what is that number like? And we're just talking three initial parameters. And we're going to now be getting into other issues today. But we concluded last week that if you took all the atoms in the universe, about 10 to the 78, I finished counting them last week, and you multiplied our entire universe and all its atoms by 1 trillion, 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 by 10 million times, remove one atom, no Earth, anytime, at any point in the history of the cosmos. That's how finely tuned just those three parameters. We have over 1,000, and you're all staying put till we get through all 1,000 of them. We're bringing in dinner tonight. You know. Yes.
One thing I kind of wondered about on design, intelligent design, that's like a quartz crystal.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to be intelligently designed. Appears to have information in it, yet it can occur naturally without anybody designing it.
Well, it doesn't convey purpose or information. It does have. Actually, its patterns are relatively simple, but they're multiplied, you know, many times. You know, so that would not fit the definition of design. You know, like crystals, for example. So, let's get to galaxies. We covered the atom briefly last week, and now we'll get into galaxies. Yes, Ted?
I'd like to take off on Mark's example there. Supposing you had a book with half a million pages in it, and the term zero was on every page.
Mm-hmm.
Half a million zeros. You look at the first page, you've got all the information you're going to get. Looking at all million pages.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to do you any more good.
It's somewhat like a crystal in that
That's
sense.
Right.
You know.
More information, you look at one crystal block, you've got the whole crystal.
Mm-hmm. And so, in the design argument, now, if you absorb only 10% of what I'm going to be covering today, you're doing good. So don't try to absorb all of it, okay? But get some, at least general impressions that if you absorb just 1/10 of what I'm going to be talking about, you can hold your own conversation very well to other people. Now, we talked about the three initial factors right after the Big Bang. Now we're going to talk about fine-tuning of galaxies. Yeah, turn it down a little bit so there are some really beautiful photographs here. Hopefully the lower lights won't put you to sleep. I'll try to be as dynamic as I can be with the lights lower, but these photographs are really beautiful photographs. Okay, right now there's about 300 finely tuned galactic parameters needed to get an Earth-like planet. When you see these numbers inside parentheses, that indicates the percentage variance you can have and still get an Earth-like planet. So if something has a 10% variance, it means it can go, you know, plus or minus 5%, for example. And you could still get an Earth-like planet. More than that, you destroy any possibility of getting Earth out there. Well, like real estate, galaxies, location is very important. That has a 10% variance. You can see these numbers are quite a bit higher than the numbers we've been covering so far. But their cumulative net result, we will see at toward the end of the presentation, is quite phenomenal. We'll get into location more in a moment. The size of the cluster of galaxies. We're in a group of about 40 galaxies, a local group. All right, and then our local group is in part of a cluster of galaxies. And then you have a supergroup of galaxies, and then those supergroups are into, I believe you would call, they form filaments of galaxies. If you were to back up far enough outside the universe and look, it almost looks like a spider web. It's filaments that galaxies are forming in. So that's new information that has happened in the last few years. Okay, so its size of the galaxy. We'll see why in a moment. Also, the variability of local dwarf galaxy absorption rate. Now, that's the one you're going to remember, right? That's simply saying, and we'll get into what that means in a moment. Okay, when we look in the universe, most galaxies are in very crowded neighborhoods, on the order of about maybe 10,000 in the local group, in their local groups. Okay, and when that happens, you get a lot of collisions of galaxies. Trust me. You don't want to be around when Andromeda does collide with our galaxy in a few billion years. So we don't have to worry about it too much right now. If you worry about that, then you have a neurosis problem or neuroses and you need help. But in our local group, we only have 40. Ah, interesting. It's one of the darkest places in the entire galaxy. So, typically 10,000, we have 40. And that's good. Because when you have 10,000, that's not good for an Earth-like planet to ever happen. Because the gravimetric tug of war would annihilate any possibility of life. Okay, in our local group, we only have two medium galaxies, us and Andromeda. That's it. All the rest are small dwarf galaxies. Okay, and so that's one parameter. There's two galaxies that are eventually going to collide. Gorgeous shots. You know, astronomers, they come up with these interesting names. NGC 1097. Boy, that's romantic. Yeah. You'd think they'd be able to come up with some better naming systems. See, so if galaxies get too close together, the result is no life. Yes?
Is there any evidence to suggest that there used to be more than 40 in our area? That maybe there used to be 400 or 4,000, and some of them collided and that?
Well, there have been some collisions, but to answer whether there were, used to be more galaxies in our local group, I think we could reasonably say probably not, and if so, you know, not that much.
How would we know, though?
By photographic evidence of looking back and deep in space.
Oh, degree.
Because the further you look back in your telescope, the further you're looking back in time. For example, when you see the sun, you're seeing light that came from the sun 8 minutes ago. Okay? Took light 8 minutes to reach us. So, hypothetically, the sun, right now, maybe doesn't exist, and we won't know it for 8 more minutes. But then we'd know it very quickly. Yes?
One of the things that Hugh Ross has pointed out is that a spiral galaxy like the Milky Way has to absorb a small galaxy every once in a while in order to maintain its spiral structure.
Mm-hmm. So you're ahead of me.
So this may be a minor factor in terms of did there used to be more? But
yeah, we absorb some dwarf galaxies. I'll get to, there's another galactic collision. Really beautiful, isn't it? But you don't want to live there. You don't even want to visit. There's one galaxy eating up another one. Now, our galaxy, you know, the spiral arms, we'll get into that in a moment, the only way they can maintain their shape of the spiral arms is if our galaxy eats away at dwarf galaxies that are outside our galaxy. Small galaxies, dwarf galaxies. If we didn't have those dwarf galaxies, we'd be toast. Or we would never have happened in the first place, all right? So you need the main galaxy to be able to be fed. It gets hungry. And so you have to feed it in order to keep its spiral arm shape. You don't keep the spiral arm shape, you have no Earth-like planet possible. And so, there's, like we said, we're not going to go through all 300 galactic factors, so you can relax on that. But as you see here, the galaxy age, the galaxy type, its mass distribution within the galaxy, and so on and so on. Now here's a... Okay. That's the galaxy bulge. That's the center of the galaxy. There's, from another point of view, if the galaxy bulge is too large, you have too much radiation, no planet Earth. If it's too small, then you've got other problems. If a galaxy is too young, it won't have enough suns to generate rocky planets. It won't have enough generations of stars. Because you're all familiar with, I think, that stars have birth and death. And when they go nova or supernova, they spew out their ingredients in outer space, as do other stars, and eventually that stuff starts to accumulate by gravimetric forces, and eventually it condenses and ignites and becomes a new star. And so you have, right now we're in the second or third generation of stars in our galaxy. But that takes millions and billions of years to do that. Now, see, in between spiral arms, right in there, that's where you want to be. If you pass through a spiral arm, not good. So only 5% of the galaxies in the universe can theoretically support an Earth-like planet because of the various almost 300 factors that you have to consider in getting the right kind of galaxy. Yes?
I just wonder, is there any evidence at this point that says that we need the big galaxy clusters way out there to help us?
That's a very good question. Do we need some of the 10,000 member big galaxy clusters out there in order to have something like our galaxy local group of 40? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think we can answer that yet. That would be a good question to ask Hugh. Okay? Yes?
It'd be good to point out when you talked about theoretical, the important part of that word theoretical is that we have not observed a single galaxy that can support, you know, advanced human life yet, other than what we live in.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to define that word theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
There may be one out there, but we haven't found it.
Yeah, we haven't found it yet. Like, we haven't found a twin star yet that's a twin to our sun. And you need a twin star in order to get an Earth-like planet. So far, we've cataloged millions of stars. None of them match our sun yet, and that's what you need.
Yeah, John,
yes.
That's the point. Earlier, you were saying, like, of a dime or
mm-hmm.
a jewel, John, the universe was formed the way it is in all the galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the reason that you need all the matter, mass, energy of all those other galaxies, or the...
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, in that sense.
And the mass and energy of the universe would be different, and consequently,
mm-hmm.
like you said...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mass of the universe is finely tuned to 1 out of 10 to the 60th. Now, what that means is, if you were to fill all 200 billion galaxies with dimes, and you remove one dime, you get no Earth at any time, anywhere in the cosmos. Now, that's true for just after the Big Bang. Fine tuning, okay? And that's how... Yes, so we need... why all that out there? Guess what? That's the reason. You need it. So people say, how can you have life just on this planet? Which may or may not be the case. God could do whatever he wants with other planets, other galaxies. But I tend to think we're probably the only one. But you need all those stars out there to get Earth because of the fine-tuning just after the Big Bang. Okay? So if a galaxy changes shape, you got problems. with heavy elements versus not enough heavy elements like iron, copper, and so on. And if the opposite direction, you don't have the right size and characteristics, then you can get maybe too many heavy elements and not enough light elements like hydrogen, helium, and so on. And so you end up in problems. Yes?
Now, one thing we ought to qualify this a bit is that a lot of these very finely tuned parameters do apply to conditions that existed very early in the universe.
Yes.
And
those are the initial factors that I termed.
No longer are things that affect everyday star formation.
Oh, yeah. If you took a star away today, it's not going to affect the cosmos.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is that there's no reason that those finely tuned parameters preclude additional Earth-like planets elsewhere in the galaxy. There could be lots of them.
Right. That's why I say for at least one Earth-like planet. Could be more. Could be more. From a theoretical viewpoint. Yeah, the first three factors that I discussed and the mass, that would be fourth, were true just after the Big Bang, and that's why I call them initial factors. Here's a dwarf galaxy that's called the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's near our galaxy. You could see it has an unusual shape to it. So galaxies can come in all shapes and sizes just like people. Okay. So, after you get through with everything, only about 1% of all the galaxies in the universe are hypothetically, you could say, hypothetically, only 1% of the galaxies in the universe could house an Earth-like planet. Now, I'm not saying they do house an Earth-like planet. That's hypothetical. But only 1%, this is factual, only 1% are capable of supporting an Earth-like planet. And maybe the Milky Way is the only one. I tend to think that's the case. Okay, so you've seen a number of things about galaxies. Now, let's get to our star, the Sun. You could see on the picture there, that's the approximate size of the Earth. In fact, that's quite a bit too large in relation to our Sun. Okay, so there's about 140 finely tuned parameters that you need, finely tuned, to get an Earth-like planet. And I'm going to list a number of those factors. I'm not going to enumerate them all here. I don't want to put people to sleep. But so I'm not going into detail on these things. But again, our Sun is location. If it's too far away from the galactic center, we got problems. It has to be just in the right spot. It's our location relative to spiral arms in a galaxy. And again, if we crept into a spiral arm in our rotation around the galaxy, we would be toast, be radiated to death. Okay, so you have to have just the right orbit at just the right speed, just the right distance from the center of the galaxy. And we'll get into types of supernovas in a moment. Now, location, location, location. God's the first one that came up with that saying, not your real estate agent. Okay. So not only is the importance of location true for your galaxy, but it's true for where your Sun is, your home star. And this goes all the way back to when our Sun was first formed. It had to be at a very specific location. We'll see in a moment. But if you have too many stars nearby, no life. And so on. And so you have collisions, interruptions, gravimetric pull that can warp our planetary orbits, can warp our Sun's orbit around the center of the galaxy. So you see here, if the Sun's orbit's too elliptical, you get no life. It has to be in an almost perfect circle, as you see superimposed on a picture of a galaxy. And if it's not between spiral arms, no life. And you have to be in what's called the Goldilocks zone in terms of rotation around the center of the galaxy. Yes, Russ?
John, when you say no life possible, are you talking mostly about radiation?
Yes. Radiation and, in some cases here, gravimetric pull. You know, we would be too close to other stars and they would pull on us, and it does not make for a good stable orbit of our of a planet, which you need for life. Yes.
And it's also for the rocky planets. When you get further away from the center, there's not enough material to make rocky.
So yeah, you have to...
Too close to the rocky, too close to too close to the radiation, too far away from the rocky.
Yeah, for example, out here, you don't have enough metals to form a rocky planet out there. If you get too close, well, you're dead from radiation from the center. And you're dead if your orbit eventually creeps into one of these spiral arms. There's a little bit better of a picture of our Earth compared to the sun. Between 1.3 to 1.4 million Earths can fit inside our star, the Sun. Now, how did our star begin? In order to try to avoid getting into too much detail on this, take it as this. Our Sun was initially formed inside a spiral arm itself. Not a good place to be. It had to be ejected from a spiral arm to in between two spiral arms. See all the fine tuning needed for that. All the, you know, if this happens, if this happens, if this happens. Our star, the Sun, before it formed, had to be, where it started to form, had to be near several other types of stars that went nova or supernova. That's when a star explodes at the end of its life and throws its ingredients outward. And so we had to be near three types of supernovas, meaning our sun, at just the right spot, at just the right location, at just the right time in the universe, is age, in order to eventually get our star, the sun. Okay? So that's why supernovas donate material. Eventually, they form our new sun. Yes?
How long does it take a star, like if our sun, to become supernova?
Billions of years. Now, our star's not big enough to become a supernova. It'll become a white dwarf. For example, if you really want to get technical, you know, you have fluorine in your body, right? Okay, it's called a chemical, it's called fluorine. Without it, you wouldn't live. You know where fluorine comes from? It comes from a white dwarf star being close to a bigger star and the transfer of material between those two stars. That's where you get fluorine. That's the only place you get fluorine in the entire cosmos. And so if we didn't have that big star and the white dwarf star and the three supernovas near where our sun would soon to be, we wouldn't be here talking right now. So you can see all the things that have to be just right. Now, and we've talked about that near the supernovas, and timing is everything. I won't get into all those. Alright sun's characteristics have to be just right. The kind of metallicity content, its luminosity, its color, its mass, and so on, agnosium, have to be just right. How'd you like to be that close to the sun? There, that's Earth there. That's not our approximate distance from the sun, heaven forbid. But that's showing a comparative size. Okay? When it comes to stars, size does matter. If it's too large, it burns out too quickly. It takes it a few million years to burn out. And therefore, you couldn't have a life-sustaining planet. If it's too small, small stars burn too erratically. Can't have life in that case. That's a pretty... This is the exterior edge, or outer edge, of a supernova remnant. After a star goes explosion at the end of its life. Okay? and these are what form new stars. Just a photograph there, home movies. Isn't that beautiful? A lot of different stars along with dust. Now, there's our sun compared to Antares. We fit up to 1.4 million of Earths inside our sun, the star, and now look at how small our sun is. It's a medium-sized star compared to some of the big giants out there. Do you feel insignificant yet? Okay.
How far is Antares?
I don't know the answer to that question. How far is Antares from us? Well, you just better pray it's not too close. You don't want to get too close to that guy. Okay, our star, the sun, if its luminosity was much more in relation to its existence in time, you get no Earth at any time. For example, if our sun's luminosity, the brightness of our sun, if it increases, it increased maybe as much as 30%. I've heard like 20 to 30 in that range from its beginning when life first started. Now, unfortunately, if our sun's luminosity changes by 1 to 2%, there's another fine-tuning factor, it would fry us. We'd be dead. But yet we're still here. How come we're still here and the sun has changed anywhere from 20 to up to 30% of luminosity since life started on this planet about 3.8 billion years ago? But we're still here. Why aren't we fried? Well, that's what's called the faint sun paradox. We'll get into that momentarily. But there's conditions on the Earth that make the Earth more efficient on releasing energy, heat. And so as the sun gets brighter, the Earth gets better at releasing heat. And it's been in perfect synchronistic combination with one another over the past almost 4 billion years. And that's design. That doesn't happen by chance. It's a perfect dance. Yes?
Does it mean because of also the magnetic field around the Earth?
No, but you touched on a factor that's important, the magnetic field of the Earth. We'll get to that in a few moments. That has to be finely tuned. And it happened by a very unusual set of circumstances, okay? So the Earth gains efficiency over time to lose heat. And this depends on a bunch of different stuff. How's that for a scientific statement? A bunch of stuff. You have to have the right life forms on the Earth at any given time. He was talked about that, as the Bible says, God takes away certain life forms at various times. They go extinct, and then he reintroduces new life forms. Well, that's in order to help with the growing luminosity of the sun. It has to be in a perfect synchronistic inverse relationship to one another. Tectonics affects our ability to lose heat. Volcanic activity affects our ability to lose heat. And so on and so on and so on. It gets very complex. But all these factors are finely tuned to enable us to lose heat more efficiently because of the sun's growing luminosity and therefore growing heat. And no random process can account for this. None. So the brighter the sun gets, if we stayed the same, we'd be dead. The Earth has to change in inverse relationship to the growing luminosity. Yes?
Since this is an ongoing thing, like the basic paradox and so on and so forth, I don't understand how, like, theistic evolution, if you think, oh, God started it.
And then he backed away. Yeah, theistic evolution would say, depending on the brand of theistic evolution, there's weak and there's strong theistic evolutionists. Won't get into that, but that weak versus strong depends on who you're talking to and whether they what they are promoting in way of the degree to which God intervenes in the process.
Okay, he has to intervene every second.
Yeah, stuff like this mitigates very much against theistic evolution.
Definitely.
Now, let's get to the planets. You think, well, we just have, you know, 8 planets. Sorry, Pluto.
Yeah.
there is rebellion running amok on this planet that refuses to drop Pluto from being a planet. But at any rate, so here's Saturn eclipsing the Sun, taken by one of JPL's spacecraft. There's about 137 parameters on level planets that have to be just right in order to enable an Earth-like planet. Okay. Note, I'm not getting into all the statistical numbers on all this stuff because I don't want to put you to sleep. So just get the general concept of what's being talked about. For example, our distance from the star, our sun, the star, if our orbit on average were to differ by more than 1%, we wouldn't be here. That's pretty precise. Our distance from the gas giants in our galaxy, 2% variance. For example, Jupiter, if it were 1% closer, we wouldn't be here. If it were 1% farther, probably wouldn't be here. Meaning, if it were 1% closer, it would disrupt our orbit, which needs to be a certain shape to have life, and it would make our orbit too elliptical, non-circular, and we would be toast. So this is true for Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. All these gas planets are necessary for our existence. And so, yeah, if it were further away, it probably would not protect us as well from incoming meteors, comets, colliding with Earth. In other words, Jupiter and the other gas planets act as a gravimetric shield, if you will, to help ward off incoming missiles from outer space, if you want to call them that. Okay. Now, that shows you about the size of Earth in relation to Jupiter. You could fit about three Earths inside that famous red spot on Jupiter. And that's a hurricane that's been going on for at least 300 and something years. Galileo saw it. We don't know how long it's been there. But we could put about 1,400 Earths inside Jupiter. Okay, if Jupiter's mass were smaller, we probably wouldn't be here because it wouldn't be able to protect us from extinction events, from meteors hitting us. If Jupiter's orbit were less circular, again, similar problems. It would disrupt our orbital plane, which needs to be almost perfectly circular. And get this, if Jupiter had not formed at the exact moment, take exact with a little grain of salt, I'm not talking within seconds, okay? But Jupiter had to be formed at just the time that the disk of debris around the sun disappeared. You know, as you know, when stars form, they ignite, they leave some dust behind, that dust eventually becomes coalesces into planets. Well, if Jupiter had not formed at that exact moment, it would have collided eventually, spiraled inward to our sun, and we'd be toast. Or maybe you wouldn't even have the bread have a chance to be put into the toaster. We would never have gotten that far. That almost looks like an old phonograph record, doesn't it? Those are rings going around Saturn.
That Jupiter formation, are you referring to the fact that then later there wouldn't be enough debris to form Jupiter, and earlier if there was enough debris it would have caused collisions with Jupiter?
I'm not sure of the mechanism that would cause Jupiter to spiral inward. I'm not sure what that mechanism is, but I know if it wasn't formed at just the right moment, forget about any Earth. And so this stuff could go on, we could go on for hours talking about this stuff. And here's some other factors you can read on the screen about planets have to have all the stuff finely tuned. For example, if our orbit were like this instead of like more or less like this, we wouldn't be here. Okay. There's Mars. That's much bigger than the Grand Canyon. That gash. Here's some of JPL's photographs. Now, there's one of Jupiter's moons, Io, 62 at last count. That looked neat. Makes you hungry, doesn't it? Well, we had pizza this morning, so. And there's the first photograph of an active volcano outside of Earth in our solar system. That was an amazing discovery. But interesting that we've observed up to 100 of these things all erupting at one time. Very active moon.
Volcano is mainly sulfur, isn't it?
Well, on that moon, I wouldn't venture to say that. I don't have the technical knowledge to know whether it's mainly sulfur on Io. On Earth, it's a different matter.
But this way, it's not lava.
Yeah. On some planets, and that might be the ice being shot up. Isn't that a different situation? Yes?
All of these things you're telling me now, these are part of that 1,000 parameters?
Yes.
Second of all, how many moons did you say?
62 at last count. Now we're down to the Earth and Moon. We're getting toward the bottom rung of the ladder, if you will. Almost 200 and, well, almost 300 finely tuned parameters for Earth need to be just right in order to get an Earth-like planet. For example, again, we talked about our distance from the sun, the shape of our orbit, the axis tilt. You know, our axis tilts at 23.5 degrees. Any other tilting would be very, very precarious. Very precarious. Our rotation rate. Did you know that when life first started on this planet, about 3.8 billion years ago, that the rotation period was only about, what, 4 to 6 hours for a day. And about that high off the ground, about a foot or two, the wind speeds would be like 2,000 miles an hour. For bacteria, you could handle it. But anything else? Not even cockroaches can tolerate that. magnetic field. We'll be getting into that in just a moment about the magnetic field of the Earth. Here are a bunch of other atmospheric conditions that need to be just right in order to allow life. It doesn't get life, but just to allow the possibility of life. And I won't read all those. You can view them there. Even electric discharge rate, lightning. Don't have lightning? Forget it. We wouldn't be here, for example. And as he has talked about volcanic activity, we need it. We need typhoons and twisters and hurricanes. Because if we didn't, we would not be here. All that has to be finely tuned. Okay. The ratio of land to ocean is very important. Now, here's some more surface factors that have to be just right in order to get life possible. To belabor the point, for example, in our crust of the Earth, if any of these were off by more than 10%, no life. Zinc, vanadium, chromium, selenium, iron, tin, phosphorus, nickel, manganese, iodine, fluorine, boron, copper, arsenic, and cobalt. Any one of them off by more than 10%, we're screwed. And the Earth is unique so far in our research. The Earth is unique in the amount or abundances of these various chemicals that are just in the right amounts to enable life and advance life also on Earth. Other planets have radically different chemical ratios than we do. Other stars have radically different chemical content.
Just to back up about how the Earth was like 4 hours it took.
Mm-hmm.
I would love one day for you to do the moon.
Well, I'll be getting there in a moment, a little bit.
So, everyone, mm-hmm. No one will ever look at the moon the same way.
Now, I got probably a little ahead of myself. Sometimes I do that because I don't read my presentations whenever possible. I hate it when people read their PowerPoint presentations. You know, it's more of a backup for the presenter to use. As I said, the sun is much more luminous today than it was back when life first formed, and yet a 2-4% change in luminosity would kill, at this time, would kill all life on Earth. And so therefore, we have the faint sun paradox, as previously mentioned. The Earth has to get more efficient at losing heat. And so you see all this argument today that we're contributing to the global warming. We're upsetting this balance, so goes the argument. And so that's going to be bad news eventually if it reaches a critical point. We have to be sure that the Earth loses enough heat. And the more bright the sun gets, the more our Earth has to lose heat more efficiently. And as we discovered, there are tons of factors, that's another scientific term, that are necessary in order to lose heat. The ratio of land to ocean mass, the amount of volcanic activity, the amount of hurricane activity, the magnetic field, which we'll mention in a moment, the kinds of life on the planet at any given time affect the ability to lose heat. The type of land masses you have, the number of silicates you have on the surface and so on, are all affect this faint sun paradox. And so all this goes back to when the sun was first formed near all those different supernovas, and a white dwarf star being near a big star and forming fluorine. All goes back in many ways to that. Now, it also goes back to the collision of Earth with a Mars-sized object real early in its history, shortly after it was formed. That affects a number of things. Okay, I covered that. Okay. Yes.
Is the Earth, maybe you know this, but I was wondering if the Earth orbit is slowly, increasing, you know, moving out away from the sun?
Mm-hmm.
That would also...
Yeah, if our orbit were to change by more than 0.5% out or 0.5% in, it's time to move. Yeah.
Going up, and we moved away from the sun, it would compensate.
If it was done perfectly in synchronicity, yes, it would. Now, as I stated, this defies any chance scenario. Has to be designed. It's too. The factors are so many, hundreds of factors. All have to be finely tuned in order to keep us alive, just on this aspect. Okay? And, of course, there are a lot of other things. The level of bombardment we get from meteors, comets, sea salt aerosols, and so on, effect. And then there's a big one. Here we go, Mara. Well, this is one of Mara's favorite. Now, I certainly wish I could have some Star Wars music come up. George Lucas copied my presentation here. So, in its early formation, the Earth collided with another planet in the same orbit as we were.
This is a theory.
No. Well, it's theory, but it's so well attested to by mathematical models and all the available data. It's at the outer edge of theory becoming, you know, fact, kind of provable fact. Okay? When this collision occurred, the two merged into one planet and formed our moon. Okay? So the Earth and this Mars-sized object planet, the Mars-sized planet had to be just the right size. It had to hit us just the right angle, about 45 degrees, at just the right speed. All of that had to occur just perfectly.
What if the Earth was bigger at the time?
That's an interesting question. What if we were bigger? Don't know the answer to that. You wouldn't want to get too big. There's a certain limit there on how big our star, our Earth can be, especially in relation to its distance from the sun. All those, you knock anything out of whack very much, and you destroy all possibility of life. But the moon, yes?
We were bigger, we have larger gravitational attraction.
Yeah, you're right, greater mass.
Which would keep some things in the atmosphere that we don't want in the atmosphere, so we change the atmosphere.
Methane. Okay, good point. So we wouldn't be able to lose certain things as easily, like methane, for example, which helps heat our planet. We want to lose the heat. It could affect water, yeah, couldn't exist in its three given states.
Well, that was the sense that caused this overabundance of water that the thought about taking us from the water.
Mm-hmm. When the moon collided with the Earth, when the Mars-sized planet collided with Earth, it donated a lot of our iron core that happened as a result of that collision. Okay, you'll notice that the moon is a lighter materials. The center of the Earth with its iron core, that affects a number of things, as we'll see in just a moment. Talked about that, about how fast the Earth was going around at the time that life just began. But because of this collision with the moon, we got just the right tectonic activity that's affected by the donation of material from that Mars-sized object, forming the iron core, which affects the amount of radiation we get, uranium, thorium, and so on. So we have just the right radiation, because radiation affects the amount of volcanic activity, the amount of tectonic earthquake activity. All that had to be just right. Had to be just the right planet to hit us. Had just the right composition when it collided with us. Okay? And I can't resist that one. That's me up on the moon.
That's a Hollywood.
That's a what?
Hollywood set.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I fooled my wife with that picture for years before we got married. She thought it was so cool. Okay, so the moon collision, or the collision that created the moon and our current Earth, was very, very critical. For example, our Earth was more somewhat like Venus in terms of heat. Venus is 800 plus degrees on the surface. It has a runaway cloud situation there and traps the heat. If we had not had that collision, we would be like Venus in many respects. Also, we had too much water at the time before the collision. So we went from a total water world to about a 2-3% water content in this world. Too much water, bad for life, because you have to have the right ratio of continental landmass to ocean mass, if you will. Again, that collision resulted in all of that. Also, the magnetic field had to be just right from that collision. No collision, you wouldn't have had this. You wouldn't have had just the right amount of iron core, which affects our magnetic field, and that protects us from radiation. Before that collision, you wouldn't want to be here. So, to make a long story short, as of 2006, these are the numbers. Today, the numbers are even greater. For example, in 2006, there were 676 finely tuned parameters needed to get an Earth-like planet in the cosmos, at least one. Now it's over 1,000. But using 2006 numbers, the chances of all these things happening by random chance are 1 out of 10 to the 556th power. Oh, now he's back to numbers again. What does that mean? Well, try to think of this. And you'll be glad I'm not going to present you with any more numbers after this one. 1 out of 10 to the 556. It's like mark one dime, fill our universe with dimes, meaning all the galaxies. Now they consist of just dimes, right? and then you multiply our entire universe of dimes
by all that.
By vote, how many want me to read this? How many don't want me to read this? Okay, you could see, and for those people, what about those four people listening on the internet? They can't see this.
It's a lot.
How can I haven't counted the number of trillions here, but guess what? There's some more. Remove one dime, no Earth, anytime, anywhere in the entire cosmos. This says you multiply our universe by 1 trillion, and so on, and it mentions 1 trillion times by about maybe 40 times. You could say 1 trillion times by 1 trillion times, and do that about 40 times. I'm just making an estimate there. So you've got to be, excuse my vernacular, out of your ever-loving mind to think that the universe, the Earth, is by random chance. Okay? Now, we get into bacteria life. Well, it's even higher. But Harold Morowitz, Yale physicist, said, okay, what's the chance of if you took a shoebox and put all the needed ingredients in it? Now remember, that takes all sorts of high odds. But let's just say we got to that point. Get a shoebox, break a cell down on all its component parts. What are the chances of a cell forming by a random chance? And this is very artificial because you have all the ingredients there already. Hey, to get to that spot requires, as we've seen. But assuming you have all the ingredients there, this is, and he's an agnostic or atheist, he said the chances of a one cell forming by random chance is 1 out of 10 to the 100 billion, B as in boy, power. 100 billionth power. That's 1 with 100 billion zeros after it. Now, would you like me to tell you how many times I'd have to multiply the universe by 1 trillion times?
No.
Anybody want that? We probably would grow old. We'd die, and the sun would probably grow faint by the time we mentioned the number of trillions necessary. So this is why scientists, astrophysicists, and astronomers are, majority of them, believe in that God created the universe. Okay? Einstein, God does not play dice with the universe. I think we're most familiar with that. But he said, in view of such harmony in the cosmos, which I, with my limited human mind, but what does that make mine? I don't know. am able to recognize there are yet people who say there is no God. He says, that's incredible. How can you say that? But what really makes me angry is that they quote me for the support of such views. In other words, he's no atheist. He says, I am not an atheist, and I don't think I could call myself a pantheist. He also said, science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. I think there's a lot of truth to that. He said, he was asked the question, wonder if his certain aspect of his theory proved to be false. So he said, then I would feel sorry for the good Lord. The theory is correct anyway. I'm sure he had tongue in cheek. He says, what I'm really interested in is whether God could have created the world in a different way. That's a fascinating intellectual exercise. Now, here's Stephen Hawking. He said, it would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us. Now, he's an extreme deist. He believes God created the universe and the mathematics of it, the Big Bang, the mathematics and laws of physics, and then he stepped back and didn't do anything after that point. Sir Frederick Hoyle, a very famous British astronomer, said a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology. He fought the Big Bang, but finally had to admit it was true, and then he tried to say, well, life maybe came from somewhere else. Well, that's just debating the issue, isn't it, by one step. Here's Alan Sandage. Here's your quote for Alan here. He says, I find it quite improbable that such order comes out of chaos. There has to be some organizing principle. God to me is a mystery, but is the explanation for the miracle of existence. Why there is something instead of nothing. And I quote, for people listening on the internet, I quote page numbers and the books and so on, but we're running out of time. So the bibliographical references are on there. You can check them out on the website. Robert Griffin's, I love this. If we need an atheist for a debate, I go to the philosophy department. The physics department isn't much use. I love that one. Paul Davies, the laws of physics seem themselves to be the product of exceedingly ingenious design. And he also said, there is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has finely tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. Impression of design is overwhelming. I think I'll skip that one. It's a longer one because we're running out of time. And Bouncer Dave is looking at me. Here's a Russian scientist. The exquisite order displayed by our scientific understanding of the physical world calls for the divine. Here's Roger Penrose, who worked with Stephen Hawking. He says, I would say the universe has a purpose. If not, they're just somehow by chance. And let's go to the last few quotes. And he says, here's the prima facie evidence for design, the fine-tuning of the universe. And this one, I have two last ones that are great. Robert Jastrow, NASA astronomer, with concerning about how we found the Big Bang and the fine-tuning of the universe indicates intelligent design. And in that context, he said, and he may still be an agnostic, by the way, I don't know where he's at this time, but he said, concerning the Big Bang and the fine-tuning of the universe, he said, for the scientist who has lived by his faith and the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He, the scientist, has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak, now that we understand Big Bang cosmology and fine-tuning. As the scientist pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. It's a great quote. And last quote, I believe, is Jeffrey Bruebridge, UC San Diego, astronomer. He said, he was complaining that his fellow astronomers are rushing off to, quote, the first church of Christ of the Big Bang because of all of them going toward becoming a theist. So after all the evidence is looked at, and we've just looked at a thimbleful of it, in the beginning, God did create the heavens and the earth. And now the last slide after this is amazing discovery. Just came out. I'm going to beat Hugh to this one. You know, latest scientific discoveries. This image will revolutionize the way we look at things. There's the eye of God at the end of the universe. Okay. But if you're not buying it, good. That means you're still awake, right? So thank you very much. Close in prayer. Lord, thank you for your created universe. Thank you that the design is abundant. Your handiwork, the design is evidence of your handiwork. And thank you that in this more modern day, we have the ability to see all the indications of your divine hand in this whole process of the universe forming and continuing. Let us give you the glory and the majesty. In Jesus' name, amen.